Europe was a cultural and geographic entity. The world is not. That is the difference.
To the overlords, replied Stormgren sarcastically. The Earth probably is a great deal smaller than Europe seemed to our fathers, and their outlook, I submit, is more mature than ours.
I do not necessarily quarrel with federation as an ultimate objective, though many of my supporters might not agree. But it must come from within, not be superimposed from without. We must work out our own destiny. There must be no more interference in human affairs.
Stormgren sighed. All this he had heard 100 times before, and he knew that he could only give the old answer that the Freedom League had refused to accept. He had faith in Karelin, and they had not. That was the fundamental difference, and there was nothing he could do about it. Luckily, there was nothing that the Freedom League could do either.
Let me ask you a few questions, he said. Can you deny that the overlords have brought security, peace, and prosperity to the world?
That is true. But they have taken our liberty. Man does not live
by bread alone. Yes, I know. But this is the first age in which every man was sure of getting even that. In any case, what freedom have we lost compared with that which the overlords have given us for the first time in human history?
Freedom to control our own lives under God's guidance.
At last, thought Stormgren, we've got to the point. Basically, the conflict is a religious one, however much it may be disguised. Wainwright never let you forget he was a clergyman. Though he no longer wore a clerical collar, somehow one always got the impression it was still there.
Last month, pointed out Stormgren, 100 bishops, cardinals, and rabbis signed a joint declaration pledging their support for the supervisor's policy. The world's religions are against you.
Wainwright shook his head in angry denial.
Many of the leaders are blind. They have been corrupted by the overlords. When they realize the danger, it may be too late. Humanity will have lost its initiative and become a subject race.
There was silence for a moment. Then Stormgren replied.
In 3 days, I will be meeting the supervisor again. I will explain your objections to him, since it is my duty to represent the views of the world. But it will alter nothing. I can assure you of that.
There is one other point, said Wainwright slowly. We have many objections to the overlords, but above all, we detest their secretiveness. You are the only human being who has ever spoken with Karelin, and even you have never seen him. Is it surprising that we doubt his motives?
Despite all that he has done for humanity.
Yes, despite that. I do not know which we resent more, Karelin's omnipotence or his secrecy. If he has nothing to hide, why will he never reveal himself? Next time you speak with the supervisor, Mr. Stormgren, ask him that.
Stormgren was silent. There was nothing he could say to this. Nothing, at any rate, that would convince the other. He sometimes wondered if he had really convinced himself. It was, of course, only a very small operation from their point of view, but to Earth, it was the biggest thing that had ever happened. There had been no warning when the great ships came pouring out of the unknown depths of space. Countless times this day had been described in fiction, but no one had really believed that it would ever come. Now it had dawned at last. The gleaming, silent shapes hanging over every land were the symbol of a science man could not hope to match for centuries. For 6 days they had floated motionless above his cities, giving no hint that they knew of his existence. But none was needed. Not by chance alone could those mighty ships have come to rest so precisely over New York, London, Paris, Moscow, Rome, Cape Town, Tokyo, Canberra. Even before the ending of those heart-freezing days, some men had guessed the truth. This was not a first tentative contact by a race which knew nothing of man. Within those silent, unmoving ships, master psychologists were studying humanity's reactions. When the curve of tension had reached its peak, they would act. And on the sixth day, Corellon, supervisor for Earth, made himself known to the world in a broadcast that blanketed every radio frequency. He spoke in English so perfect that the controversy it began was to rage across the Atlantic for a generation. But the context of the speech was more staggering even than its delivery. By any standards, it was a work of superlative genius, showing a complete and absolute mastery of human affairs. There could be no doubt that its scholarship and virtuosity, its tantalizing glimpses of knowledge still untapped, were deliberately designed to convince mankind that it was in the presence of overwhelming intellectual power. When Corellon had finished, the nations of Earth knew that their days of precarious sovereignty had ended. Local, internal governments would still retain their powers, but in the wider field of international affairs, the supreme decisions had passed from human hands. Argument, protests, all were futile. It was hardly to be expected that all the nations of the world would submit tamely to such a limitation of their powers. Yet active resistance presented baffling difficulties, for the destruction of the overlord's ships, even if it could be achieved, would annihilate the cities beneath them. Nevertheless, one major power had made the attempt. Perhaps those responsible hoped to kill two birds with one atomic missile, for their target was floating above the capital of an adjoining and unfriendly nation. As the great ship's image had expanded on the television screen in the secret control room, the little group of officers and technicians must have been torn by many emotions. If they succeeded, what action would the remaining ships take? Could they also be destroyed, leaving humanity to go its own way once more? Or would Corellon wreak some frightful vengeance upon those who had attacked him? The screen became suddenly blank as the missile destroyed itself on impact, and the picture switched immediately to an airborne camera many miles away. In the fraction of a second that had elapsed, the fireball should already have formed and should be filling the sky with its solar flame. Yet nothing whatsoever had happened. The great ship floated unharmed, bathed in the raw sunlight at the edge of space. Not only had the bomb failed to touch it, but no one could ever decide what had happened to the missile. Moreover, Corellon took no action against those responsible, nor even indicated that he had known of the attack. He ignored them contemptuously, leaving them to worry over a vengeance that never came. It was a more effective and more demoralizing treatment than any punitive action could have been. The government responsible collapsed in mutual recrimination a few weeks later. There had also been some passive resistance to the policy of the overlords. Usually, Corellon had been able to deal with it by letting those concerned have their own way, until they had discovered that they were only hurting themselves by their refusal to cooperate. Only once had he taken any direct action against a recalcitrant government. For more than 100 years, the Republic of South Africa had been the center of racial strife. Men of goodwill on both sides had tried to build a bridge, but in vain. Fears and prejudices were too deeply ingrained to permit any cooperation. Successive governments had differed only in the degree of their intolerance. The land was poisoned with the hate and the aftermath of civil war. When it became clear that no attempt would be made to end discrimination, Corellon gave his warning. It merely named a date and time, no more. There was apprehension, but little fear or panic, for no one believed that the overlords would take any violent or destructive action which would involve innocent and guilty alike. Nor did they. All that happened was that as the sun passed the meridian at Cape Town, it went out. There remained visible merely a pale, purple ghost, giving no heat or light. Somehow, out in space, the light of the sun had been polarized by two crossed fields so that no radiation could pass. The area affected was 500 kilometers across and perfectly circular. The demonstration lasted 30 minutes. It was sufficient. The next day, the government of South Africa announced that full civil rights would be restored to the white minority. Apart from such isolated incidents, the human race had accepted the overlords as part of the natural order of things. In a surprisingly short time, the initial shock had worn off, and the world went about its business again. The greatest change a suddenly awakened Rip Van Winkle would have noticed was a hushed expectancy, a mental glancing over the shoulder as mankind waited for the overlords to show themselves and to step down from their gleaming ships. 5 years later, it was still waiting. That, thought Stormgren, was the cause of all the trouble. There was the usual circle of sightseers, cameras at the ready, as Stormgren's car drove onto the landing field. The Secretary General exchanged a few final words with his assistant, collected his briefcase, and walked through the ring of spectators. Karelin never kept him waiting for long. There was a sudden, "Oh!" from the crowd, and a silver bubble expanded with breathtaking speed in the sky above. A gust of air tore at Stormgren's clothes as the tiny ship came to rest 50 meters away, floating delicately a few centimeters above the ground, as if it feared contamination with Earth. As he walked slowly forward, Stormgren saw that familiar puckering of the seamless metallic hull, and in a moment, the opening that had so baffled the world's best scientists appeared before him. He stepped through it into the ship's single, softly lit room. The entrance sealed itself as if it had never been, shutting out all sound and sight. It opened again 5 minutes later. There had been no sensation of movement, but Stormgren knew that he was now 50 kilometers above the Earth, deep in the heart of Karelin's ship. He was in the world of the overlords. All around him, they were going about their mysterious business. He had come nearer to them than had any other man. Yet he knew no more of their physical nature than did any of the millions on the world below. The little conference room at the end of the short connecting corridor was unfurnished, apart from the single chair and the table beneath the vision screen. As was intended, it told absolutely nothing of the creatures who had built it. The vision screen was empty now, as it had always been. Sometimes in his dreams, Stormgren had imagined that it had suddenly flashed into life, revealing the secret that tormented all the world. But the dream had never come true. Behind that rectangle of darkness lay utter mystery. Yet there also lay power and wisdom, and perhaps most of all, an immense and humorous affection for the little creatures crawling on the planet beneath. From the hidden grill came that calm, never-hurried voice that Stormgren knew so well, though the world had heard it only once in history. Its depth and resonance gave the single clue that existed to Karelin's physical nature, for it left an overwhelming impression of sheer size. Karelin was large, perhaps much larger than a man. It was true that some scientists, after analyzing the record of his only speech, had suggested that the voice was that of a machine. This was something that Stormgren could never believe.
"Yes, Ricky. I was listening to your little interview. What did you make of Mr. Wainwright?"
"He's an honest man, even if many of his supporters aren't. What are we going to do about him? The League itself isn't dangerous, but some of its extremists are openly advocating violence. I've been wondering if I should put a guard on my house, but I hope it isn't necessary."
Karelin evaded the point in the annoying way he sometimes had.
"The details of the World Federation have been out for a month now. Has there been a substantial increase in the 7% who don't approve of me, or the 12% who don't know?"
"Not yet. But that's of no importance. What does worry me is a general feeling, even among your supporters, that it's time this secrecy came to an end."
Karelin's sigh was technically perfect, yet somehow lacked conviction.
"That's your feeling too, isn't it?"
The question was so rhetorical that Stormgren did not bother to answer it.
"I wonder if you really appreciate," he continued earnestly, "how difficult this state of affairs makes my job."
"It doesn't exactly help mine,"
replied Karelin with some spirit. I wish people would stop thinking of me as a dictator, and remember I'm only a civil servant trying to administer a colonial policy in whose shaping I had no hand. That, thought Stormgren, was quite an engaging description. He wondered just how much truth it held.
Can't you at least give us some reason for your concealment? Because we don't understand it, it annoys us and gives rise to endless rumors.
Karelin gave that rich, deep laugh of his, just too resonant to be altogether human.
What am I supposed to be now? Does the robot theory still hold the field? I'd rather be a mass of electron tubes than a thing like a centipede. Oh, yes, I've seen that cartoon in yesterday's Chicago Tribune. I'm thinking of requesting the original.
Stormgren pursed his lips primly. There were times, he thought, when Karelin took his duties too lightly.
This is serious, he said reprovingly.
My dear Ricky, Karelin retorted, it's only by not taking the human race seriously that I retain what fragments of my once considerable mental powers I still possess.
Despite himself, Stormgren smiled.
That doesn't help me a great deal, does it? I have to go down there and convince my fellow men that although you won't show yourself, you've got nothing to hide. It's not an easy job. Curiosity is one of the most dominant of human characteristics. You can't defy it forever.
Of all the problems that faced us when we came to Earth, this was the most difficult, admitted Karelin. You have trusted our wisdom in other matters. Surely you can trust us in this.
I trust you, said Stormgren. But Wainwright doesn't, nor do his supporters. Can you really blame them if they put a bad interpretation on your unwillingness to show yourselves?
There was silence for a moment. Then Stormgren heard that faint sound. Was it a crackling? That might have been caused by the supervisor moving his body slightly.
You know why Wainwright and his kind fear me, don't you?
Asked Karelin. His voice was somber now, like a great organ rolling its notes from a high cathedral nave.
You will find men like him in all the world's religions. They know that we represent reason and science, and, however confident they may be in their beliefs, they fear that we will overthrow their gods. Not necessarily through any deliberate act, but in a subtler fashion. Science can destroy religion by ignoring it, as well as by disproving its tenets. No one ever demonstrated, so far as I am aware, the non-existence of Zeus or Thor, but they have few followers now. The Wainwrights fear, too, that we know the truth about the origins of their faiths. How long, they wonder, have we been observing humanity? Have we watched Mohammed begin the Hegira, or Moses giving the Jews their laws? Do we know all that is false in the stories they believe?
And do you?
Whispered Stormgren, half to himself.
That, Ricky.